In 1947, pilot Kenneth Arnold sights a series of unidentified flying objects near Washington's Mount Rainier. It's the first widely reported UFO sighting in the United States. The media just went crazy. Thanks to Arnold's description of what he saw, it leads the press to coin the term flying saucer. Arnold was an experienced pilot with more than 9,000 hours of flying time. He had diverted from his flight plan to Yakima, Washington, to search for a Marine Corps C-46 transport plane reported down in the Cascades near the southwest slope of Mount Rainier. A sweep of the area revealed nothing, and Arnold resumed his original course. Listen in now to this 1947 original interview with Kenneth Arnold.
Newscaster in every newspaper across the nation has made headlines out of it, and this afternoon we are honored indeed to have here in our studio this man, Kenneth Arnold, who we believe may be able to give us a first-hand account and give you the same on what happened. Kenneth, first of all, if you'll move up here to the microphone just a little closer, we'll ask you to just tell in your own fashion, as you told us last night in your hotel room and again this morning, what you were doing there and how this entire thing started. Go ahead, Kenneth.
Well, about 2:15, I took off from Chehalis, Washington, en route to Yakima, and of course, every time that any of us fly over the country near Mount Rainier, we spend an hour or two in search of the Marine plane that's never been found that they believe is in the snow someplace southwest of that particular area. That area is located at about, or its elevation is about 10,000 foot, and I had made one sweep in close to Mount Rainier and down one of the canyons and was dragging it for any types of objects that might prove to be the Marine ship. And as I come out of the canyon there, it was about 15 minutes. I was approximately 25 to 28 miles from Mount Rainier. I climbed back up to 9,200 feet, and I noticed to the left of me a chain which looked to me like the tail of a Chinese kite, kind of weaving and going at a terrific speed across the face of Mount Rainier. I at first thought they were geese because it flew like geese, but it was going so fast that I immediately changed my mind and decided it was a bunch of new jet planes in formation. Well, as the planes come to the edge of Mount Rainier, flying at about 160 degrees south, I thought I would clock them because it was such a clear day, and I didn't know where their destination was, but due to the fact that I had Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams to clock them by, I just thought I'd see just how fast they were going, since among pilots we argue about speed so much. And they seemed to flip and flash in the sun just like a mirror. And in fact, I happened to be at an angle from the sun that seemed to hit the tops of these peculiar-looking things in such a way that it almost blinded you when you looked at them through your plexiglass windshield. Well, it was about 1 minute to three when I started clocking them on my sweep second-hand clock. And as I kept looking at them, I kept looking for their tails. They didn't have any tails. I thought, well, maybe something's wrong with my eyes. And I turns the plane around and opens the window and looks out the window, and sure enough, I couldn't find any tails on them. And the whole observation of these particular ships didn't last more than about 2.5 minutes, and I could see them only plainly when they seemed to tip their wing or whatever it was, and the sun flashed on them. They looked something like a pie plate that was cut in half with a sort of a convex triangle in the rear. Now, I thought, well, that maybe they're jet planes with just the tails painted green or brown or something, and didn't think too much of it, but kept on watching them. They didn't fly in a conventional formation that's taught in our Army. They seemed to kind of weave in and out right above the mountaintops. And I would say that they even went down into the canyons in several instances. Oh, probably 100 feet. But I could see them against the snow, of course, on Mount Rainier, and against the snow on Mount Adams as they were flashing, and against a high ridge that happens to lay in between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. But when I observed the tail end of the last one passing Mount Adams, and I was at an angle near Mount Rainier from it, but I looked at my watch, and it showed 1 minute and 42 seconds. Well, I still thought, well, that's pretty fast, and I didn't stop to think what the distance was between the two mountains. Well, I landed at Yakima, Washington, and Al Baxter was there to greet me and saw up here. And he told me, I guess I better change my brand. But he kind of gave me a mysterious sort of a look that maybe I had seen something he didn't know. And, well, I just kind of forgot it then till I got down at Pendleton and I began looking at my map and taking measurements on it. And the best calculation I could figure out, now even in spite of error, would be around 1,200 miles an hour, because making the distance from Mount Rainier to Mount Adams, in, we'll say, approximately 2 minutes, it's almost, it'd be around 25 miles per minute. Now, allowing for error, we can give them 3 minutes or 4 minutes to make it, and they're still going more than 800 miles an hour, and to my knowledge, there isn't anything that I read about outside of some of the German rockets that would go that fast. These were flying in more or less a level, constant altitude. They weren't going up and they weren't going down. They were just simply flying straight and level, and I laughed and I told the pilot at Pendleton, they sure must have had a tailwind, but it didn't seem to help me much. But to the best of my knowledge and the best of my description, that is what I actually saw, and like I told the Associated Press, I'd be glad to confirm it with my hands on a Bible, because I did see it. And whether it has anything to do with our army or our intelligence or whether it has to do with some foreign country, I don't know. But I did see it, and I did clock it, and I just happened to be in a beautiful position to do it. And it's just as much a mystery to me as it is to everyone else who's been calling me the last 24 hours wondering what it was.
What an incredible story. Kenneth Arnold was 32 years old at the time. He died just before his 69th birthday in 1984. In a moment, we'll be talking with one of his daughters, Kim Arnold, and Paula Harris on Coast to Coast AM. You know Paula Harris, but let me introduce Kim Arnold. Kim is the third daughter of Kenneth Arnold. Kenneth, of course, as you just heard, is considered by historians as the man who started it all, the father of the modern era of UFOs. Back in 1947, he innocently became the most famous man in the world at the time. He reported seeing 9 strange aerial objects at phenomenal speed over the Cascade Mountains in the state of Washington near Mount Rainier. And, of course, the word flying saucer was coined in world history by the way he described how the objects flew, as you just heard. Here's Kim Arnold on Coast to Coast. Kim, how are you?
I'm just fine.
Great to have you with us. What's it like when you hear your father on old tape like that?
Well, it brings back a lot of wonderful memories.
It sure does.
It really does. He was a very special man.
He passed away in 1984, mm-hmm. right before his 69th birthday. I can feel for you. I just lost my dad about a month ago. Did he talk much, Kim, about this episode?
Well, see, I hadn't been born until 7 years after his sighting.
Okay.
I was born in 1954, and his sighting was in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, as a young girl growing up, he had repeated his story so many times to so many people that he would just say, go read my book. He was kind of burned out on it, you know.
He probably was. I mean, he got attacked by the media at the time. Oh. Everybody wanted him on.
Well, it wasn't just the fact that he got attacked by the media. You know, he was just they were just being bombarded at their personal home by, you know, letters. They received 10,000 letters from people all over the world. Their phone wouldn't quit ringing. He had, you know, interesting people knocking on his door, you know, all the time, you know, wanting to discuss what they had seen or wanting to discuss their interesting experience. And it just turned my parents' lives upside down.
You know, I've long believed, Kim, that things happen for a reason, that there are no coincidences in life. And it's very ironic that his sightings occurred right around the time that we had the crash at Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, one would have to assume we're talking about the same craft or series of craft that he saw and that one that crashed in Roswell. Did he ever mention that to you, Roswell, New Mexico, in that episode?
No. Actually, he thought that was very strange, all about the crash and everybody thinking that these were aliens or they were, you know, something that were made out of metal or something that could crash. And, you know, he didn't have that concept about what he saw at all. Not in the least. Basically, towards the end of his life, he was really brave enough to come out and say in 1982, in an article that he had been interviewed with a journalist, that he actually believed that they were living the craft that he saw, he believed they were alive. And that's what he thought for many years.
That's after fascinating.
He saw them 8 times, you know, during his lifetime.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've tried to go back and really document all the different sightings that he'd seen. But, you know, the first sighting, June 24th, was really the most famous sighting, and it was one that was very historically documented. Then he had another sighting over, it was just July, it was, I think it was in July of 1947, and it was, you know, he was on his way to Tacoma, and he saw 25 brass-colored duck-like things, but he said they were very similar. They flew in the same kind of pattern that the first flying saucers that he saw, but they were completely different. But he did have a sighting over Susanville, California in 1952 that was very, very fascinating. Two of these flying saucers, these craft, flew under his airplane. One was as solid as a Chevrolet car, and the other one, he could see the pine trees through the center of the craft.
That's strange.
And then he realized at that time, they had the ability to change their density.
And almost cloak themselves.
Well, they have the ability to change their density, that's for certain.
Yeah.
And the other thing that he, you know, repeatedly noticed about the craft, especially the ones he saw on June 24th, and that's kind of my hidden secret over here. I kind of feel bad no one knows about it, really. But they pulsate. At first, he did think it was reflection off of the craft that was making the brilliant flashes of light.
Right.
But as he reflected on what he had seen, he really realized that it was a pulsation from the center of their surfaces that was so interesting, because they pulsated similar to the beating of a human heart, and he believed that they were alive.
So, yeah, that would convince me that it was almost organic in his mind.
Oh, absolutely.
When he saw this
never
beating.
Thought they were he was really kind of perplexed by everybody's, you know, I mean, all these, you know, these flying saucers that were metal, and, you know, everybody, you know, had this idea that they were put together with nuts and bolts and things like that. But that was never his impression of them.
Kim, at the time, he did not say that it was extraterrestrial. He didn't know.
No, in the very beginning, of course, just like his, you know, his tape said, at first he thought they were some type of jet aircraft.
Yeah.
But he couldn't see their tails, and that just perplexed him. And so he even had to roll down the windshield of his plexiglass windshield of his airplane to look at them to make sure he wasn't seeing. You know, he wanted to see their tails. I mean, that was really the whole point there. He wanted to identify them as some type of aircraft.
Yeah. He wanted them to be planes.
Well, of course he did.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, he just figured they were probably, but boy, they sure were going fast.
Did he ever start talking about extraterrestrials or that kind of craft later on in life?
No, not at all. In fact, he believed that they were this is kind of brave for me to say, but in 1982, he really, you know, that was just, you know, 2 years before his death.
Yeah.
He said that he believed that they were the link between the living and the dead. Mm-hmm. That's what he believed.
How did he come up with that?
I think he was probably wondering, like everybody else, what it was like to really die and where we really went or where we, you know, where we go when we die.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his first conclusion was, which is, he was a very common sense person. He used his common sense.
Nuts and bolts type of guy.
His ideas were very common sense, you know, focused.
Yeah.
And he just figured that, well, we don't take our physical bodies with us. I mean, we don't. So he believed that they were alive, and he sincerely believed that they were this link between the living and the dead. That's what he believed.
Interesting theory. Doubleday, the huge publishing company at that time, mm-hmm. offered him a lot of money.
$50,000.
In those days. That's in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost like a $1 million contract today. And he turned it down?
Yeah, isn't that really perplexing? Why? Okay, my opinion. I think possibly, and there's no way to really document this, but my opinion is, because of the way I know the way my dad felt about things, and number one, it was a very spiritual experience for him.
Okay.
I mean, he really felt dedicated that this had happened to him for some reason, and he was very perplexed about that. And I believe Doubleday their contract, I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing their contract was extremely long and very complex. And I think somewhere in there, it gave them the right to fictionalize what had happened to him. And he would not go to that length. He would not do it. So
that's,
he walked away.
Point.
He walked away from Doubleday, and he got involved with a man named Ray Palmer.
Well, I remember that. Ray was a publisher at the time, wasn't he?
Pardon?
Wasn't Ray a publisher at the time?
Yeah, you know, Ray Palmer was kind of an interesting gentleman. He was an editor at Ziff Davis Publishing back then, and he also had a little publishing company called Venture Press. And my dad had gotten 10,000 letters from people all over the world, and, you know, he happened to pick up Ray Palmer's letter, and he kind of read it, and he kind of liked the way that he sounded. He sounded kind of sincere, kind of down to earth. And before you know it, you know, Ray Palmer was kind of into his life. And, you know, it was very interesting. After reading the historical documents, it was very clear to me to understand why he developed a relationship with Ray Palmer. Ray Palmer had told him in 1939 that he'd had a flying saucer experience.
Did they stay friends then?
Well, yeah, they stayed friends in the beginning. They stayed pretty good friends. They did. I would say it was a very long distance relationship. My father lived in Boise, Idaho. He lived in you know, Chicago, and so what they did is they kind of, you know, back then telephone calls, of course, were quite expensive.
That's right.
They didn't have the kind of, you know, communication thing we have today. So they sent these little records back and forth and recorded things and talked that way. I would say they remained good friends, although Ray Palmer was a very shrewd businessman, and my dad didn't really understand the publishing business, so.
But Ray did.
Yeah, he really did. He
yeah.
was kind of an interesting man, you know. He was only 4 feet tall, and he had been in kind of, I understand, a truck accident when he was a young boy at 7 years old, and he had, I think he'd broken his back, and
the
operation to repair his back was very unsuccessful, and so he was a hunchback, and he never really, you know, physically developed properly. Not that there's anything wrong with that at all. I mean, my dad had nothing against that whatsoever, but, you know, Ray Palmer, you know, because he'd had this accident, he just threw himself into the science fiction world, you know, the fantasy world type place. And he did a lot of reading in that area. And somehow he got into the publishing business, and that seemed to be, you know, where his heart was at, was, you know, publishing.
Yeah, I know. I remember his books. I mean, I was a kid. I was born in 1950, but later on, I mean, the name Palmer, I remember. And, you know, he loved this field. He jumped right in it.
Well, he was a very interesting man. My father found him to be a very interesting man. You know, he introduced my father to OWASPE, you know, the interesting Bible that was, you know, he introduced him to OWASPE. He introduced him to the Book of Charles Fort, the Book of the Damned.
Sure. Huge book.
Well, you know, it really helped my father because after, I mean, he wasn't into this stuff at all, you know. So when he started reading the Book of the Damned by Charles Fort, he realized, my word, these interesting things have been around since the beginning of the human race.
Whatever they are.
Yeah, they've been around forever.
We're going to hit this break, Kim, and when we come back, we'll have Paula chat with you as well. She's a great researcher, as you know, and found you for this program. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's time for the Coast to Coast merchandise blowout. Here we go. This entire month of January, it's like opening up the door. It's like one of those blue light specials. We just open it up and let you run in and buy the products at a steep discount. These things have been there for years. They're all brand new, shirts and caps and things like that. And what we've decided to do is to go to a different kind of coast-to-coast store, which you'll get some new products in about a month or so. But we're going to highlight special products that affect you, that you use in your day-to-day life, whatever it might be. You know, we were talking about selling little portable breathalyzers, as a matter of fact, to keep you safe so you don't drive and, you know, and drink. And so we're going to do things like that. I just want these to be beneficial to you. These other things are fun, and that's why we're just about giving them away. You can get 25% off your order. And by the way, when they're gone, they're gone. Just go to coasttocoastam.com, go all the way down to the bottom, click the store, and there's a coupon code to take advantage of the discount, which is C2C25, which stands for Coast to Coast 25 for the 25% off. C2C25, and then click activate, and off you go. So let's clean out the store and bring in the new. And welcome back. I hope you haven't missed any of this tonight. We're with Kim Arnold, one of the daughters of the late Kenneth Arnold, of course, who spotted some very strange craft back in 1947, and researcher Paula Harris. Paula, we blocked some time for you to chat with Kim this segment because you, as the researcher, and you brought Kim to this program. I want you to pick it up and chat with her a little bit, okay?
Okay. Well, George, you might want to know that there's a little coincidence here because Kim and I had been talking. We've been talking for the last 4 months because what she has to say is so important, and she'll tell you about her website. It'll be on there. But I had been talking to Tom Danheiser in October, and he asked me, he said, when would you like to come on? And I threw out a date. And the date that I threw out, which was January 16th, happened to be coincidentally the anniversary of the death of Kenneth Arnold.
Yes, that's right.
But I wasn't conscious of that. I just threw this date out of nowhere. And when I told Kim about it, she almost said, well, it's almost meant to be. Isn't that right, Kim?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, it was just, I think it was a very, you know, odd coincidence. But then, you know, possibly with synchronicity, you know, I was supposed to really take hold of my father's materials and really do something to preserve his name for history.
That's right. It's always surreal. And there are no coincidences. Everything happens for a reason. Paula,
yeah,
put on your reporter's hat and let's go. I want to hear this.
Well, it's great. We could do this together. Well, you know, Kim, what really impressed me about you, though, is that you really do know what to talk about with your daughter, with your father. You have so many details, and you might want to talk about what your plans are to put this in a book.
Oh, well, my book is coming out at your convention, so I want everybody to know that. Is going to be, the title is Kenneth Arnold, the Man Who Started It All, and it's going to be released for the very first time May 19th through the 20th at the 2012 Women's UFO Symposium in Glen Rose, Texas.
Yeah, and it's really ironic because, you know, I want to highlight a lot of women. I mentioned Angela Joyner and Linka Tai. Carol Rosen will also be there. And, you know, the thing that's important is that women are important in UFO history, and the fact that you do come forth and you're going to talk about this, we have to have a perspective of how this all happened. And the longer we wait, the more we're going to lose the people that started it all.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt at all.
Well, Paula, I think it's very important that people really were going to find out through me and through my writings as to what type of person my father really was. They're going to, you know more about his character, know more about him as a man, and I think that will definitely, you know, be a very important thing for the preservation of ufology.
Well, Kim, you know, I think George would like to know this too. What effect does a family, what happens to a family when a member of the family comes forth like that? I mentioned that it wreaked havoc on your entire family. Can you tell us your mother, how she reacted, and everyone else in your family?
Well, of course, you know, again, I wasn't born at the time my dad had his sighting, but it deeply affected our family. My father became the most controversial. He became the most famous man in the world over the most controversial subject that there ever has been in humanity. So, you know, you put one and one together, believe me, it was very difficult. Growing up, we knew our father to be, I mean, he was a very nuts and bolts person, a very reputable, honest man. He, you know, once he had told his story and that was, he was honest about what he had seen. And of course, you know, he made his report, you know, because he thought possibly that these objects that were traveling could possibly have been Russian missiles. And, of course, it had only been 23 months since the bombing on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. And nuclear war was, you know, just everybody was on the edge about nuclear war with Russia. So, you know, it was a very difficult time. I think the funniest thing, not the funniest thing, but the cutest thing my dad ever said is that in one of the very first articles is that, boy, he just wished he could get on one of those flying saucers and just fly away from all of it, you know.
I could see.
Oh, it was dark. I mean, really, it was one of the cutest things he ever said.
But he also underwent a psychiatric exam for the FBI. Yeah, he did everything he was supposed to do.
No, how did that happen and why?
Well, I don't really remember that particularly. I think that he said that he would take one. I don't know, Paula. Maybe that's something you know that I don't know. But I don't really remember anything in the documents that said that he actually took one, but possibly he did.
In his biography, he said he would undergo anything that the intelligence community would want him to do, including undergo...
Oh, of course, yes. Of course he would have said that. Of course, yes.
And also, he also said, and we know this for a fact, the pilots have to undergo these kinds of exams anyway to get a pilot's license. So, you know, especially the physical. And you know, that means your eyesight has to be good. That means every part of your physical being has to be good. And so, you know, he cooperated in the beginning. But tell us, Kim, what happened towards the end? I mean, this went on for a long time, and part of it, you know.
Oh, towards the end of his life, then?
Yeah.
Oh, well, he became a bitter recluse, basically. It seemed like everybody that, you know, he got involved with, they just kind of said, you know, they listened to him. And then, of course, in the beginning, especially, they just ran off and printed any kind of a story. And he got very, you know, confused and very upset about a lot of that because, you know, half the time they didn't really put it down properly or they didn't do it correctly, and that bothered him. And so actually, towards the end of his life, he didn't talk about the subject a whole lot. He kind of shunned UFO groups. I mean, he just didn't want anything to do with them. He thought this whole thing about the aliens coming and these spaceships coming that were nuts and bolts, he thought everybody had kind of turned it into a circus. In other words, he still felt dedicated to what he had seen and to what he knew was a fact for him. And, you know, he didn't really understand all this alien stuff and everything that all these other concepts that people were talking about. He thought they sounded kind of silly, really.
Paula, what do you think of the strangeness of timing with Kenneth Arnold's sighting and then the Roswell crash? Don't you think it's probably the same craft?
Well, Kenneth Arnold's craft was Chevron-shaped, from what I understand. They were oddly-shaped craft, I mean, from what I see that he drew. And the Roswell craft has, I think, another form. It has another form. So I don't necessarily believe it's the same craft because Kenneth Arnold isn't the only one to see UFOs in that area. Right around Mount Adams, Washington State, there were all kinds of sightings. And then Kim was telling you that his second sighting was orbs, which was mainly gold orbs. And so it's really confusing, George, but what I was going to ask you is this classic, George, where somebody is very sincere, reports their sighting, gets a lot of publicity, gets a lot of hassle, and then closes the door on this whole thing?
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is a great story. Probably one of the best, Paula. You and Kim are sitting on a story of history. You really are. When I heard his tape, it kind of gave me chills.
He was enthusiastic. He was trying to explain to the people what he had seen. He was enthusiastic. He was clear. He wanted to do a good job. And then towards the end of his life, Kim used the word circus. It became a circus. And I got to honestly tell you that sometimes when I go to some conferences or when I'm with a certain group of people or it feels like a circus, and it's very difficult to navigate in this when you're a serious researcher.
Yeah, it really does. So, Kim, over the years, did you uncover anything in your father's notes or anything that would be shocking to all of us?
Well, I don't know if it's shocking or not, but, you know, when people go to my website, really, I think they'll find it very interesting because And I have one category. It's KennethArnoldUFO.com. And I do have one category that's called The Files. And actually, it is a story about really what I did discover in The Files. And I think the thing that really astounded me more than anything, you know, of course, he just had boxes of stuff. I mean, my dad was kind of interesting. He was on a kick of trying to solve the UFO situation himself. So, you know, he figured that nobody else was solving it. So he was busy cutting out newspaper articles and taping it, you know, pasting them down in these notebooks. I mean, it's just an incredible story, really it is. Trying to figure out, you know, he was keeping track of the sightings over, you know, on the other parts of the world and everything. It really was kind of funny.
Do you know if he was ever approached by the Men in Black or anybody who wanted him to just be quiet?
Oh, well, that is kind of an interesting story, to be honest with you. You know, after his sighting, he really thought that maybe he was supposed to do speeches on this to kind of make people aware that these things were real, they did exist, and so he started doing some speeches. He did. He did about two or three speeches, and then here in Boise, and then actually he had a speech all planned to go to speak at the Knife and Fork Club here in Boise, and all of a sudden he printed up all these booklets for the, you know, speech and everything, and all of a sudden, like, oh, he wasn't supposed to talk there. No, something had happened. And they were visited by military intelligence. And, you know, the powers to be basically told him that, no, they didn't want him doing any speeches on any more speeches on this. You know, they were kind of afraid of him because he became so famous so quickly. So really what happened is that, you know, and I, you know, George, my mother told me the name of the gentleman that came out to the house. I must have been quite young, maybe I was 12 when she told me the story, but what happened is that someone came out, you know, the town of Boise was only 30,000 people back then, so right. Everybody knew everybody. And a gentleman came out that knew my father, took him out to the country, took him out to the desert all by himself in the car, and told him, he said, Ken, these government men are nothing to mess with. He said, I have a brother that works for the government, and he's seen them eliminate their own men.
I believe that.
And no, seriously, yeah. It was a serious threat. In other words, do you understand? This man had kind of been told, you know, tell Kenneth Arnold in a nice way that he better not do this or he will be eliminated. So believe me, he came home, told my mother the story. And as little children growing up, you know, we were always told where to find the house key if something happened to them. So I am 57 years old, and it's taking me this many years to believe, like, maybe all the government men that said that are now gone.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, you know, I mean, Paul, I mean, I was kind of afraid to even come out and even be part of it at 57 years old, you know?
Yeah, I can attest to that. It took a long time it was 4 months we've been talking, Kim.
Well, Paula, come on, be realistic. You contacted me 4 years ago.
Yeah, I did. But you know, the reason why is because I have a historical perspective. And let's thank Chantal, because Chantal really was the one. And that's Kenneth Arnold's granddaughter.
Oh, yeah, she's quite a character.
But, you know, she is the granddaughter of these people. And I want to also say that Colonel Philip Corso has three grandsons who were very attached to the grandfather. And that's the reason why Colonel Corso spoke. It is kind of a family legacy that they leave behind, these courageous people. And Kim, you're doing that in that you're giving us the background of this, because nobody has spoken about Kenneth Arnold in all these years, really. It's been very difficult to find real information. So getting it from first sources like you, the source instead of gossip, is the only way to do this.
Well, it is kind of sad, Paula, really, because, you know, going through the internet, you know, I see this and I see that. And I mean, I saw some YouTube. I mean, everybody's trying to make their own little, you know, YouTube things. And I saw some YouTube thing the other day and it said, you know, he enjoyed his notoriety. And I thought, really? You know,
yeah.
So it really is, you know, it's time for me to come forth. And for, you know, historical purposes, I need to take this material and put something together that my father would be proud of. And that he would know that would be honest, sincere, and accurate.
Kim, what do you think he saw? What do you think he saw?
What do I think he saw?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I have a tendency to believe, like both of my parents, I believe that it's possibly that it's just a different way that we travel in the etheric world when we die, that we travel in all different kinds of ways. I mean, I think that we travel, well, I'll tell you, George. There was, in one of the last interviews my father did in 1981, he told a journalist that when he was 7 years old, he had seen a globe of light along with others in the room where his great-grandmother lay in state. So this, this globe of light thing seems to be kind of connected with people that are dying. You know, it seems to be something that shows up. Now, you know, we don't know for sure what it is. All we can do is speculate and wonder and, you know, come to conclusions. But he also, my dad was into, search and rescue, you know, and he talked with people in search and rescue quite a bit. And they said that they actually see these kind of phenomena of globes of light, and they have to do with people that are dying or that have died.
Paula, did you know that he thought it was biological?
No, I didn't. But, you know, that fascinates me because David Adair, Michael Wolff, a lot of the people that have been talked about at Kraft as live or biological skin, that they have a live and biological skin, that the creatures or whoever they are that are you know, inside are one with the Kraft and they fly it with mental, you know, their mental capacities. I've heard these things. I'm trying to collect all these stories so that I can connect some dots someday. The idea that this craft had the pulsating of a human heartbeat fascinated me when Kim told me this, because the idea of it being alive, it being created to fly in maybe in another dimension. You remember, George, you always asked me if it's paranormal, interdimensional, or interplanetary. Mm-hmm. Well, she's talking about the paranormal right now, Kim. And this is related. This is all related. I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with the conclusion that it's spirit world, but it is a paranormal kind of situation. It's another dimension we're looking at. It's not maybe in this fourth density that we live in, and every once in a while when they blink out and in like that, they go in and out of dimensions. We don't have a science yet to be able to measure this.
10 days after Kenneth Arnold's sighting, a United Airlines crew reported 9 similar discs flying over Idaho. Something was going on during this time period, Paula.
Yeah, I think Kim can speak to that because that's the Captain Smith that Kenneth Arnold was friends with.
Yeah.
And they are the ones that researched the Maury Island case in Washington State. Mm-hmm. And so Kenneth was very, very interested in following up. I mean, when somebody else has that sighting and he's the United Airlines pilot, I can see where he would want to meet him. And I think they did some work together. Is that right, Kim?
Oh, well, Captain E.J. Smith and my father became very good friends. Yes. Basically, what happened there is that my dad was it was in Seattle at the time. He had actually, it was with a gentleman. He'd taken him on a fishing trip. It was July 5th, 1947, and they had wanted to go fishing, so my dad figured he'd get away from all the hubbub here in Boise. He just wanted out of all the newspaper call reporters and everything that was going on. So he decided to go, you know, fishing with a friend. And their fishing venture didn't work out.
Hold on for a second, Kim. We're going to take this break. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about this, then have an entire hour of phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.